So, disclaimer, this, you know, the album just dropped last, you know, last month. It was the last thing we did before the new year. This talk got put together this morning, all right? So, I still think it's actually pretty good. I mean, I'm thinking maybe I should start doing that as a matter of course. Nonetheless, and of course, I'm open, and I'm very open to questions and criticism and stuff. But the criticism part, I'm not that open to. The questions I'm really good about, but not the criticism. But anyway, so this is some work we did. It's kind of a revival of some old work I did with one of my old, my graduate students, Dan Cormier, back in the day. Probably some of you might not have been born then, which, you know. But there's been a lot of talk about how natural inflation is the right thing to do for inflation, especially in light of various Planck results and so forth. And so, but there are some issues if you are a believer in the effective field theory, which I quite honestly, I find it hard not to be a believer. I mean, it's like, you know, do you believe in breathing? Yeah, I think I do. It's sort of like that. So there are some issues around, and so I want to discuss what the issues are, sort of take my time a little bit through, and then talk about what spinodal really means. What is that word? How does it show up? And if you're a condensed matter person, you know what it means because it shows up there. So, and so as I say, as Kendrick said, this is work I did with Andy Albrecht and his student Ben Richard when I was visiting Davis last semester. It is great being on sabbatical. I have to tell you, a year-long sabbatical is about the you know, it's God's gift to mankind, right? So let's start off with the basic problems. Why so flat? Why, let's, you know, the what's called the so-called eta problem. So what are the issues? If you like inflation, and again, much like breathing, you know, who doesn't, right? I'm sorry. You know, to me, inflation is like breathing, you know? It's just like that.
You're still breathing.
Are you? Are you? I mean, we could take all day on that, right? But if you are an inflation believer, let's just suppose that you were, you would certainly want to get enough e-folds out of, you know, you'd have some potential that you dearly love for a variety of reasons. We all had our favorite potentials back in the day. And one of the things you check is that you would actually have the potential to be flat enough for long enough so that you would get the 60 e-folds of inflation or more that you would want to solve the horizon flatness problems. So these are the constraints, the two slow-roll parameters, or at least the first two slow-roll parameters. There's an infinite hierarchy of them, but we'll settle for these. So, okay, so, you know, so what did we do back in the day? We had a potential, checked that these were true, and many of us just put the ball on the potential, let it roll, and we're pretty happy with that. If you were a little bit more careful and actually cared about field theory, cared about quantum physics, you'd start worrying that maybe this isn't, you know, this isn't whatever potential you wrote down isn't the full description of the system. And in particular, you really should have been thinking about effective field theory. So again, back in the day, in the 80s when this stuff started coming out, people weren't really thinking along those lines. That was sort of a 90s and further description of what, you know, of how to think about field theory. But deep down inside, you really should have been thinking of effective field theory, valid at some scales, you know, some cutoffs, up to some cutoff scale, below the Planck scale, on or about the Planck scale. And, you know, and you would, the next thing you would think of that if you, once you made that decision to treat things as an effective field theory, your next concern would be, well, gee, there are higher order terms, there are quantum corrections that would generate higher order terms to that potential. Are those controlled? And in particular, is the flatness of the potential somehow protected against those corrections? And generically, the answer is no. You know, the flatness is not protected against quantum corrections. You know, so if you, for example, think about integrating out, I like Danny Baumann's language for it, Planck slop, and you sort of integrate out sort of Planck scale, Planck mass type fields or cutoff scale type fields to generate your effective field theory. In general, you would generate all sorts of terms if you don't have any symmetries in the problem to protect you against them. So in particular, if you start off with a potential V, One of the terms that you could generate is a dimension six term that looks potential times phi squared over lambda squared, of the many terms that you could generate. If you look at this term, I think I've just lost power in my pointer, so I guess I have to go to the hockey stick, which is, he said where it was. It's hiding, right? That's probably back here. Okay, it is probably a good thing to hide a hockey stick in a physics institute, don't you think? I mean, I could just imagine all sorts of things that could happen. So at any rate, you get corrections to the eta parameter. Well, let's talk about that. So if you're Wilson, you would say that your Wilson coefficient would be order one. And then you would also say that, well, gee, let's see. Lambda is at most M Planck. So this quantity is bigger than one. So you got order one, bigger than one, you got a factor of two. Delta eta is at least order one. Whereas you were really, really hoping that you could keep eta much less than one during the inflationary period. So that's a problem. So that's essentially the destabilization of the flatness of the potential by quantum corrections. And this is the generic situation. So, you know, so if you want to avoid genericity, you try to look at some, you know, corners of field space where things might be more interesting, and, you know, and some of these terms protected by symmetries. So for example, you'd look at supersymmetry, which would be great because you get this total cancellation of things, except for the fact that supersymmetry has to be broken, and it will be broken during inflation, essentially by the rolling of the field. And so that kind of protects you, but not enough, okay? So what to do?
So
this is the problem with coming here and giving a talk like this, is that everybody knows the answers. So yeah, let me talk about the shift symmetry. So let's talk about, you know, so where do we get the right symmetry? So there's Mr. Natural, and we're gonna talk about natural inflation. You guys are all way too young, but back in the day in the Bay Area in the 60s and 70s, Mr. Natural was quite a fixture of the what they call the counterculture scene. And if you had certain proclivities, you really, you know, enjoyed Mr. Natural quite a bit. I'm not saying I did, but, you know, others, definitely others. my friends, you know, they all inhaled. But so the question is, how can we protect the flatness of the potential? And one of the ways that's been suggested, other than supersymmetry, is to use a shift symmetry. So if you impose the symmetry that phi just goes to phi plus a constant, and that has to be a symmetry of your action, there's not a whole lot that survives. Basically, only derivative type terms that kill off the constant. No potential type terms at all, which is a little harsh, right? Because you do want a potential, you do want the ball to roll down to somewhere and actually end inflation and so forth. So this is a little too much, but it's in the right direction, right? I mean, it is going to protect you. If you had that symmetry, it would protect you against the quantum corrections that you're afraid of. So who has this kind of symmetry? Well, one of the fields that has it are Nambu-Goldstone bosons from a spontaneously broken continuous symmetry. Essentially, the low-energy theorems, you know, however you want to say it, tell you that you do not have, all you have are derivatively coupled interactions and terms. So that's perfect for this, but again, no potential. One way to do that, one way to take care of that problem is to take that continuous symmetry that you had, break it explicitly by a small amount, somehow controlled, and then generate some potential that has memory of the shift symmetry, but is a potential that you can use to do inflation off of. And that's exactly what happens in QCD when you try to solve the strong CP problem with an axion. You introduce a U1 Peche-Quinn symmetry. You have a Goldstone mode for that, but you choose everything in just the right way so that the Peche-Quinn symmetry that you want has a QCD anomaly. The QCD anomaly essentially breaks the symmetry in such a way as to generate a potential for the axion, for the would-be Goldstone boson, so the pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson. Okay, and actually, it's, you know, people always write this form of the potential down. It's actually a little more subtle than that. I mean, if you look at the Vafa-Witten theorem and what it really says about what happens when you break a chiral symmetry, it doesn't automatically lead you to this, but this is, at least at tree level, the form of the potential that you would get. So there's, as always, right, there's always some subtleties with these things. But what Fries and Adams and Freeman and Olinto did back in the early 90s is to basically take the hint from the axion case and say, what if we try to use this for inflationary potential? Well, in the real thing, you just don't know. I mean, you know that it is a periodic function of phi over f and it has certain properties, but you can't necessarily just say it's of this form. And in particular, one of the things you would worry about, so just maybe getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, one of the things you would worry about is that it's instanton effects that are giving rise to this potential. And what you do is you restrict yourself to those single instanton sector to generate this. And the hope, of course, is that the higher instanton sectors are suppressed, the contributions are suppressed relative to this. And sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. And if you get higher order harmonics of this, that starts to destabilize things. So there are issues involved there as well, and how that winds up solving the strong CP problem. When you look at the Vafa-Witten theorem and you're careful about it, you can actually argue that whatever the form of the potential, it will solve the strong CP problem. But it takes more argument than what's usually done.
In addition to this problem, what about the, I call it the Paul Steinhardt nightmare, the quantum fluctuations runaway eternal inflation?
Not doing that, but you'll see why in just a second. Or in a while. I'll get to it, promise, kind of. This was the starting point for natural inflation. So, you know, it's great. You've got your cosine potential, you stick the ball near the top, let it roll, and inflation happens. And so this got a fair amount of airplay back in the day, and then since the Planck results have come out, and actually a lot of this winds up being motivated by the BICEP results, which of course, you know, may or may not be there in any real form, but nonetheless, they were useful in forcing us to think about this more carefully. So what does it take to get a good inflationary scenario out of natural inflation? Okay, and by good, I mean the usual things. I mean, we get enough e-folds and things match up to observation. So for example, when I compute R and I compute NS, scalar spectral index, from that potential, from that inflationary scenario, I want them to match up to the Planck data, okay? Or to Planck plus BAO plus et cetera data, okay? And this did not come out as well as I wanted, but fair enough. So Veronica Sands and Kroon, you know, just came out with a paper a little while ago where they're looking at natural inflation and ways to fix it. And they have a nice little graph here that I pilfered. So what does it take to get good natural inflation? So you have to sort of fix the number of e-folds you want over here. This is phi as a function of number of e-folds. Phi e is when inflation ends, when epsilon and or eta become of order one. And what you find is that, can't really see it, but there's a couple of lines here that are, the line that you can probably see is the 68% confidence contour for R and NS. But what you see is that this, and M tilde Planck is the reduced Planck mass.
Or even, I think, even from 2013, it was less than 4.
Then, for which?
For R.
For R. Honestly, it won't matter.
Yeah.
Okay. Because these are the values of F. And F is essentially the amount by which the field rolls during inflation. F is the fiducial value for the value of phi that during inflation. And what you see is that if you want to match things, if you want to get things right, F has to be bigger than the Planck scale. Okay? Which, all right, so, you know, you have to decide at this point, you know, go further, call it a day. On the other hand, I mean, natural inflation has some interest, you know, has some nice points to it. So the question is, and so most people stop at this point and just say, well, F has to be bigger than Planck. somehow we'll sort this out, but we're going to keep naturally inflating. So Will Kinney and Katie Fries came out with a paper not too long ago where they just put in all the constraints from everywhere to look at models of, you know, models like natural inflation and exactly natural inflation and things could have related to it and try to, you know, see how it fits the data. They really like it. Other people like it too. And of course, axions and string theory seem to talk, you know, are happy campers together. There are a lot of axions and string theory models. So from both a theoretical perspective and maybe an experimental perspective, there are lots of reasons that you would like to be able to use an axion type field for inflation. But, you know, this has got to keep you up nights a little bit, you know, like, you know, me last night, for instance. So the question is what to do. So what, you know, so let's talk about the problem. You know, do a hard pointing out of the problem. So if you believe in effective field theory and you thought your cutoff was less than the Planck scale, you're looking at field excursions that are larger than your cutoff. So right then and there, the validity of your effective field theory breaks down. Another way to say it is that during inflation, these non-renormalizable terms that you somehow had hoped were suppressed, remember, once I have a potential, I don't have that shift symmetry anymore to protect me against terms like this. I had hoped that somehow they wouldn't be there because of the fact that this thing came from being a pseudo-Golson boson, but now everyone's there, right? And so, so these higher order, as phi gets, you know, as phi traverses this field space region, these terms actually start to dominate over what you had before, and you ruin the flatness. You ruin the whole purpose of doing natural inflation.
How did
that shift
symmetry though?
Well, the V of phi breaks the shift symmetry, right?
But they still have a discrete shift symmetry.
Yeah, but so right. So but now
those guys
will just break, you know, those guys are, you can't rule them out. You know, in print. So or if you don't like it, I could have I could have higher order cosines, if you know. So if I think of this as being the field that has a Golson mode, this would now generate higher order cosines, cosine 2 phi, 4 phi, et cetera. And that would destabilize the potential as well. Okay? So essentially, I like to think of this as Mr. Natural's excellent super Planckian adventure. And it's excellent for him, but not for being able to treat this as an effective field theory. Okay, so that's really the issue. The issue is the matchup between wanting to use natural inflation, needing to get the phenomenology right, being pushed to super Planckian field excursions, and then therefore being pushed to the breakdown of the effective field theory.
What about quantum gravity?
You know, to the extent that I know nothing about that, I say nothing about it. I mean, but what would you, it won't make things better, right? And once again, to the extent that I'm doing, and all the stuff that you do in inflation with this is really a semi-classical calculation. And at best, when you do the quantum fluctuations for the metric perturbations, you're doing tree-level stuff. So I'm not, quantum gravity, to the extent that I can do anything at all, quantum gravity is not a player. Okay? You know, if I understood quantum gravity, probably all these problems get solved by really understanding that. Who can truly say? To the extent that apparently by looking at the data, treating the inflaton as an effective scalar degree of freedom following some sort of potential seems to work awfully well. That's what I'm doing. Okay.
Is it obvious that if you get super Planckian field excursion, that necessarily means super Planckian quantum correlations to the axion, like you have, like dilaton or other things multiplying the potential.
I would have to look for different theories in general and hope for the best. Okay, so that's certainly one possible way out. That somehow, if you have all these other fields, they all conspire in such a way that, despite the fact that you look like you're going super Planckian, you're not. And in fact, there are ways to get around these problems. So. Basically, they require more than one inflaton in all cases. But like axion monodromy is a string theory construction where essentially the field space is essentially compact or has a monodromy so that as you go around smaller than Planck scale distances, sort of screen scale distances, you actually sort of get sent to the next sheet. So by having the field stay within distances less than a Planck scale, you can effectively, by winding around enough times, go super Planckian. So your effective field theory is still good, but you've achieved super Planckian results. Along those same lines, you can have many axions, and essentially each one of them does a sub-Planckian thing, but if you have enough of them, you can build up to a super Planckian overall excursion, which is really what you need. And ideas like aligned inflation are along the same go along the same way. So for example, with two axions, this is an idea by Peloso and company, with two axions with different decay constants, one linear combination turns into the inflaton, the other one doesn't, and you can choose the effective axion decay constant for that linear combination to be super Planckian, despite the fact that both of them started off being sub-Planckian. So there's ways out, but all these ways have one thing in common, and that is that they take the potential as given, and then put the ball on the potential and just do the classical rolling down of the ball throughout the evolution. And you gotta ask yourself, is that right? So we claim not, and so let's go spinodaling for E folds. So I am,
you
were heard the first time around, I'll get to it. So the first part of the story, and I could have just done it from this natural inflation, but this actually has more general implications. If I look at the Planck data and sort of take it the way they tell me to take it, apparently the potentials that have a concave part during the phase of inflation, that is to say small field inflation, seems to be preferred. Okay? Again, decisions have to be made whether you believe in inflation or not, whether you really believe how hard this result is, and so on. But if I look at this picture, and I'm guessing Planck wouldn't have published it if they didn't really, really mean business, right? That seems to be, certainly being concave does a little bit better in R versus NS space than being convex during inflation. Okay, what does that really mean? For these concave potentials, there's a line called the spinodal line. This is where, this is not rocket science. You, above that line, the effective mass squared of the field is negative. Below that line, it's positive. That's the line where V double prime equals zero. Okay, I don't know where the language comes from, to be honest, but they use it in condensed matter because that's how the process that I'll talk about in just a second is how phase separation happens in some materials. During a phase transition, the way you build domains of one phase versus the other happens through this spinodal decomposition. Okay, now, yeah, like I say, why they call it that, there's no spin zero. I don't know why they use that language, but that's the language they use. Like I just said, everybody just said, compute the potential. Hey, even compute the quantum effective potential, but then just put the ball there and let it roll classically. I'm going to argue that that's a bad thing to do for these potentials. It can be okay for other potentials where you're not near the spinodal line. But for these potentials, it's bad, basically because if I take the zero mode and I look at fluctuations around that zero mode, some of the fluctuations with low wave number, the very long wavelength fluctuations, are going to be tachyonic. Okay? And for inflation, this happens in flat space anyway. But for inflation, actually, it's a much worse situation, right? Because even modes that you didn't think were going to be tachyonic at some given time will get redshifted into being tachyonic at later times.
You don't worry about this, but
oh, I think you should.
Okay.
I think you should. So let's do this then. Right. So what you're trying to argue is that you would keep this term but throw this term away, and you would do that for the zero mode evolution, but not for the fluctuation evolution.
But I'm not saying that term doesn't mean do anything because you're basically the Hubble friction stops you from rolling down.
Nah, that's not how it plays out. So what's the worry? This is basically all I'm doing here is taking the field, decomposing it into zero mode and fluctuations, expanding the fluctuations in momentum modes, and looking at the mode equations. No quantum correction, nothing. Just straight up, this is what it is. And so if I'm in the regime where this is negative, then clearly I've got, you know, I'm gonna have growth of these modes. And in fact, the growth shows up in the two-point function. If I look at the two-point functions, it's going to be dominated by the low wavelength modes, and it's going to, and in flat space, it would just grow exponentially. In a de Sitter universe, it grows, but not quite as fast. But it grows, and in fact, eventually, it will grow non-perturbatively large. And in fact, that's how domains form in a phase transition.
Isn't it true that always even in the Sitter space, in Sitter, you always have negative mass for the incarnate variable and superhorizontal stuff. So there's always that's always true that there's the modes that become superhubble in inflation have negative mass. I mean, here you're just writing the field equation, but if you just do the full metric regulations.
Well, sure, but I just want to look at I want to look at what's happening to the field. So in the field case, I would say have a zero mass or very small mass. But it would be positive, and it would just roll down.
And you're ignoring the metric?
Yeah, I did. Okay. I'm doing the background. I'm only looking at the background evolution, for now.
Oh, background.
The background. This is all for the background.
But I said there's a Fourier decomposition.
Yeah, there's a Fourier decomposition. But I claim that if the modes are long wavelength enough, mm-hmm. I should really treat them as background for my Hubble region. Right, I mean, I would include those as well at some point, okay? And in fact, when we compute RN and S, we have to do that. But let me just focus on the field fluctuations.
Presumably, you get large non-Gaussian, non-linear contributions.
At some point. But in fact, well, that's part of how the discussion plays out. So I have this growth of fluctuations, and it just keeps growing. What do I do? I could just say, well, the fluctuations keep growing, weird stuff happens, call it a day. You know, it's always beer o'clock somewhere in the world, right? So I could do that. Or I could try to figure out how to deal with these fluctuations. So basically what I'm going to, yeah.
Are you saying that the solution is not an attractive, the usual statement that inflation is an attractor,
right.
Is that if you use the right co-moving, curvature perturbation, it reaches a constant at late times.
Right. So and so for the curvature perturbation, so if I were looking at those equations, that would be correct. I'm just looking at the field fluctuations. Well, in the right gauge, right.
I guess this is something that does blow up, but it's not gauge invariant, so it doesn't. There's nothing wrong with it.
Right. I mean, I guess maybe that's one way to say it. But it will contribute to the. So if I'm looking at long wavelength enough. These will contribute to, you know, to the background evolution. Just, you know, if I look at you're making me get ahead of myself, but I'll do that. If I decide that the way I'm going to source the background is by being semi-classical and sourcing it with the expectation value of the stress energy, then these fluctuations will contribute to the evolution of the background.
You're trying to do the back reaction.
Yeah.
Right, I'm trying to do the back reaction, essentially. That's, in fact, not essentially, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to find a way to include the back reaction of these fluctuations on the evolution of the background, so to speak.
That's not a kosher thing to do.
With city classical?
To source the isolated engine by an expectation of stress energy, that gets you into enormous trouble.
Sure, but I would need to know how to do quantum gravity, right? To do it properly.
Well, yeah, but it's saying one approximation doesn't work tells you nothing about what the right thing to do.
Well, absolutely. but you will agree that there is a growth of fluctuations, right? And that something ought to be done about it. So I'm just saying, okay, I'll do it in two steps, and let me see if I can convince you that I'm not too far away from doing something right. All right. But Perhaps it might be one of these things where I've given myself enough rope, right, and now it's just putting a head through. But in the wanting to put my head through, one way that you can try to take care of this is to essentially resum the perturbative expansion. And that's really, what's happening is that because of the growth of the fluctuations, the perturbative expansion is going to break down. That's really what's driving the problem. So there is something called the Hartree approximation that is the n equals 1 version of the large n approximation, so not so large. But it's something we can do. And so what that entails is, what that really entails is taking your interacting theory, turning it into a free theory, but not quite free. It still has some memory of the fact that it came from an interacting theory. And so what you do is you take interactions like psi to the 2n, and you replace it by something involving the expectation value of psi squared times psi squared, and then a constant piece. And any psi to the 2n plus 1 gets replaced by expectation psi squared to the nth times psi. That's the prescription is you want to match the 0, the 1, and the 2-point functions between the full theory and the approximated theory within a Gaussian approximation. So the theory becomes a Gaussian theory, but with the memory of the interactions encoded in a self-consistent calculation of psi squared. And we'll see how that plays out in just a second. And diagrammatically, what this does is it resums all the cactus diagrams in your various endpoint functions. So there are diagrams that don't get resummed by it, and we'll discuss that in a little bit later.
Can you remind us what the cactus
diagrams are? There are diagrams that look like cacti. So, or the Mickey Mouse, or the infinite Mickey Mouse diagrams, or things like that. So diagrams that are not included. That's not included. So let's do this. So what I'm going to do is take the natural inflation potential, plug in my field as zero mode plus fluctuations, expand the cosine out because trig I can do, and then wherever I then take the cosine of the fluctuation and the sine of the fluctuations, expand it out in a power series, do that Hartree replacement, and then resum everything. When you do that, this is what you get. Okay, trust me on this, or read the papers. Read the papers. Yeah, that would be better. But the net effect is that growth, so the good part, the growth of fluctuations actually gets tamed in the sense that I have this, as psi squared tries to get large, these exponentials start to suppress things. And in fact, if I look at the mode equation, the corrected mode equations now, they look like this, where I have my usual, I had the two pieces that I had before, but now the cosine is modulated by this exponential. So how does this play out? I have to solve this for the fk's to be able to compute psi squared, because psi squared also depends on the fk's. So that's the self-consistency of the problem. Okay, so there's a feedback, and that's how you take care of the back reaction within the Hartree approximation. Okay, so this is the zero mode equation that you get. This is these are the mode equations that you get, and then if you source the Einstein equations with the expectation value, this is what you get. You get terms that involve sort of kinetic-y looking terms, and then you get this effective potential for the system. Okay, so at any rate, this is a system of equations that you get. There are a set of initial conditions that you have to impose. I don't really want to delve into that so much, but this is what we have. So I'll stop here for questions because.
So isn't this, I think the more proper way of doing it is just a stochastic inflation framework. Because that's the full setup.
Right, you're right. So one way to say it is that, and in fact this is something that Cliff and I are working on, is that one way you could try to make sense of the Hartree approximation in a more correct sort of way is to see whether you can reproduce it via the stochastic approach.
But I think it's kind of by definition it's the stochastic framework, because what the stochastic does is just basically replaces the fluxes of the perturbations by just a random random Gaussian field. The quantum perturbation of a random Gaussian field, the same 2 point,
the
same moments, basically.
Well, the same moments up to a point, right? I mean, clear. Because so clear, so. But I don't think that's quite right, because if you, so, for example, in Starobinsky Yokoyama, right? They actually generate a 4 point that's different from a 2 point squared.
Exactly, up to 2 point.
Right. Right. So I mean, I think from that perspective, yes, and it'll suffer. This approach then suffers from exactly the same problems that the stochastic approach up to that point also suffers. That, you know, it's hard to see how to get to the non-Gaussian approximation from that.
Right, but I guess my point is that then this blow up is just the fact that if you have lots of modes, or I guess in this case, if you have a very flat potential, zeta squared is goes to infinity because the power spectrum has 1 over b prime in it.
Right, but it's, I mean, the potential is not incredibly flat, right?
But
I mean,
if you reach the top, it becomes incredibly flat. So.
Well, I mean, v prime is 0, but v double prime isn't at the top, right?
Right, but I'm saying that the amplitude of zeta,
right,
is,
right.
And
so I mean that might be another reinterpretation of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, following those mode equations and letting me do my approximation, my semi-classical gravity approximation, we have a self-consistent system, and we can then ask, how does this differ from the straight up letting the ball roll down the classical potential? Okay. And so depending on where you place the ball, there's actually a criterion that you can figure out, that we did figure out, about where you can place the ball to be not just zero mode dominated during the evolution, but fluctuation dominated. Okay, so place the ball there. And so here's what the hope is. Why am I doing this, you could ask. The hope would be that even for parameters that for the standard, what people are starting to call vanilla natural inflation, even for parameters for which that wouldn't work, where you wouldn't get enough E folds and S and R would go wrong, that you would hope that when you include these effects in the background evolution and then compute the fluctuations from that, that you could actually see, you could actually get improvement, that you would actually get more E folds from the fluctuation dominated part, from the fluctuation dominated phase, and so on. So that's the hope. And so what we now did is actually solve those equations numerically and ask what happens. So we chose. This is for a set of parameters where f is much smaller than the Planck scale. And here's what happens. So here's the zero mode. The zero mode, you know, it starts at the top. It wants to roll to pi. And the standard evolution would just have it go, you know, to pi and then oscillate about pi and be done with it. Something weird happens, right? So once I hit the spinodal line, the evolution is really quite different than you would have expected. And essentially, it's being slowed down by the generation of these fluctuations. They're acting like a medium that's actually slowing the zero mode down. That's the one way to incorporate the effect, is to really think of it as this medium that's slowing down the zero mode and keeping it in sort of that spinodal region for a fair amount of time. When that happens, so here are the fluctuations, sort of the dimensionless value of the fluctuations. And order one is essentially the beginning of a non-perturbative growth of fluctuations. So you can see that the fluctuations do grow the way they were supposed to, that sort of, you know, growth because of the unstable modes. But the resumming of it flattens that growth out. And then as the zero mode sort of gets past sort of the spinodal region, the fluctuations start to shut down. And eventually, when phi hits its minimum, the fluctuations drop back down to zero.
What happens when the fluctuations get stretched through the horizon?
Well, these are all very super horizon modes anyway, because those are the ones that you're going to count as effective zero mode. All the stuff that's inside the horizon, or the sub-horizon stuff, that's the stuff I'm going to actually use to generate my fluctuations that I care about for structure formation.
Using
ANS
and
NT
to calculate
the temperature. Right, so these guys are non-perturbative, but extremely long wavelength. They're not going to count into NS and R. It's the other fluctuations that are not included in this, the ones that don't get perturbatively stretched or non-perturbatively stretched. Those are the ones that are going to come into this. So you have to make a separation between the ones that see this tachyonic instability the most, and then the other ones.
Maybe I got confused. I thought you were just saying, and maybe I misheard, that this effect that you were pointing out was essentially when the mass was becoming positive.
The end of the effect is when the mass becomes positive. But if, you know, the tachyonic effect is during the region where the mass is negative, which is around phi order of pi over 2.
Okay, so you're saying there's a significant deviation from this tachyonic.
That's right. That's right. And essentially, because during that time, if I don't include the fluctuations, I never see, you know, this guy just rolls, nothing happens here of interest, and then the evolution is the usual one. But I'm saying that you've got to keep track of the fact that the modes that are doing this are seeing this tachyonic instability, are growing because of it, and because we've resummed that growth, I can actually follow the whole thing till the growth shuts off. So once this guy sort of crosses to where the mass squared is now positive, these guys can't sustain their growth anymore, and they drop down.
So how does that look like if you don't include this backreaction effect, the evolution of the field? How would it differ from
this? Without the backreaction? It would just, you know, it just, the ball just rolls in slow roll kind of to here and then oscillates about pi. I mean, no.
That looks like what you're drawing there.
Right, but it doesn't, it would be more like that. More just go right to it.
It might be helpful to draw
that. Yeah, it might be helpful to draw that. Of course, now we sent the paper in, so, you know, well, we're where I needed you, right? Okay, but here's a kicker of it. Here's the Hubble parameter, all right? So what happens? There's a phase where it's a standard behavior. Since F is smaller than the Planck scale, I'm not gonna get enough e-folds out of the standard behavior of the field. And in fact, you know, here it is. If you sort of work it out, it's of order 5 e-folds or so that you would get during this phase. And in the absence of this resumming of the fluctuations, that would be it. There would be nothing else. This is a model that wouldn't work, which is why you need to have F larger than M Planck in vanilla natural inflation. Okay? But now include the fluctuations. Include these non-perturbatively growing modes. What during this time, when this guy is sort of flat here, I pick up a second phase of inflation. I am now fluctuation dominated during this phase. And in this phase, I can actually pick up quite a number of e-folds. So the overall number of e-folds in this for this particular choice is about 200. But only 5 of them come from the standard picture. So, you know, the non-perturbative growth of the fluctuations essentially drives a second phase of inflation. And, just let me leave it like that. So the bottom line is that at least as far as numbers of e-folds go, models that would have been ruled out, taking natural inflation, models that would have been ruled out for not producing enough e-folds are now in fact okay, because the fluctuation part can drive the rest of the inflation.
Since it's not returned, doesn't it run away?
I resummed it. That was the whole point of the Hartree approximation. It would have run away, but I resummed the perturbation expansion, and I took care of that. That's what that damped exponential is doing for me. It's as the fluctuations try to grow, the damped exponential is saying, you know, not so much, and cutting things off. That's why it grows and then it dies off. So that was the whole point of doing that Hartree resummation. Because otherwise, you're right, otherwise it goes non-perturbative. I have no control over anything. Truly call it a day.
So I guess the real objection to this is that you're not dealing with a physical observer, you're dealing with some average quantity across with a multiverse, if you will. And locally, I mean, locally you're insensitive to this. Local observers are insensitive to this kind of, this long wavelength fluctuations. Local observers just see...
No, they see long wavelength fluctuations as part of zero.
Exactly.
And that's all I'm claiming.
And I guess
that's right. So the last 60 e-foldings are over here somewhere, okay? But it's like I was telling John, the fluctuations that are going to tell me about R and NS are not these. These are the extremely long wavelength ones that felt their tachyonicity the most. The ones that I'm going to care about for RNNS are the other ones, are the ones that are not those fluctuations. Okay, so you have to sort of split the, you have to split your modes into two sectors. One of which are not really feeling the tachyonic instability. The other ones that are.
Driven into the tower inflation.
Right.
All these
bubbles
stop.
No, I don't do that here. Okay. So what about RNNS? Well, you can compute them. It's a little, it's not harder than the usual way. It's just a little bit trickier because you have to do this split of the modes. But again, in the paper with Dan Cormier, we learned how to do that. We did that and we applied it here. So these points are sort of a collection of models that have on or about the same number of e-folds, about 200. We just wanted to sample the space a little bit. And so this is R versus an S. And the blue are if the scales that we see on the CMB sky leave at 60 e-folds versus 50 e-folds. Okay? And so I don't know if it's generic yet. We're still sort of examining the phase space a bit more carefully. But my guess is that generically, for models that have F less than M Planck, and do what we want them to do, R is going to be small, 10 to the minus. Maybe you can get up to some 10 to the minus 3, but they look like 10 to the minus 4-ish. So that would be sort of our prediction for these models, that R is going to be small. So we're really hoping bicep goes away.
We all know bicep didn't see primordial B modes, right? But the fat lady hasn't.
Look, I chased the ambulance with everyone else. I was happy to do it. I thought it was good, clean fun until, much like the bugs coming at the ambulance, you get squished. And so, perhaps this is premature. But if you're listening to people and catching the buzz on the ground, no one's saying put money on this. So. Let's put it this way: if the bicep result turns out to be right, or it's 10 to the minus 2, and they can really argue that, then this is wrong. I know at least this particular model is wrong. I would like to then sort of have one of our things on our to-do list is to scan across a larger panoply of models and see whether or not there's a theorem of some sort that tells you that you're always bounded by, if you want to be less than M Planck, you're always bounded in R by something.
But now you lose gravitational wave tilt in T.
Life is just brutal sometimes.
We can't check these models.
We've lost. Is that my fault? I mean, here's what I say to you. Is that my fault? It's nature. Nature is just being incredibly harsh and using the hockey stick to beat me upside the head, right? It is what it is. I mean, let the data be the judge, but this is what our predictions are for this particular model set of parameters, okay? But NS is good. NS is within the contours that we want. So I'd claim victory. I'm gonna be like that. I'm gonna claim victory. This was just a last minute slide. It turns out that you can actually mock this whole dynamics up by looking at the sort of the long wavelength fluctuations and treating it as essentially a second scalar field. And the background dynamics actually gets generated by a two-field potential that looks like this. But that's only for the background. It's not like there's actually two different fields. It's just that part of the fluctuations of the one field, the very long wavelength pieces, can actually be reincorporated into a second scalar field. It gives the same answers. It's just kind of sort of a quick way to do things if you don't feel like running a lot of code. So there's that. Now don't look at that.
You just incorporated the correction to the background. And
yeah, yeah.
Shouldn't you do simultaneously calculate? But you have, it's like as if you have calculated two function once, then put it in background, then redid the two-point function.
Well, no, different modes, right? I'm using different modes. Yeah, I mean, one of the modes are the set of modes that you will never see come back into the horizon. And the other ones are the ones that did, right?
Yeah. Coming from the ones that haven't come back yet.
Right. The ones that, basically, especially if we're in the sitter phase now, ones that will never arrive back into our horizon. So, okay, take home lessons, questions, and stuff to do. So the first take-home lesson, which I think, you know, should have been known, we kind of probably always knew it, but we never actually wanted to do the work. If you're going to do inflation, you've got to do the quantum dynamics right. So what that means is, not just don't just take the effective potential of the system, but you have to, if you're going to argue that that's sufficient, there is an argument that you have to make. You have to argue that you don't have these fluctuation things doing stuff. And in fact, if you're doing large field inflation coming from the top of the hill down, there's no spinodal region, you don't have this issue. It's all good, okay? If you believe in Planck and you're in a concave region, then it's not so all good, and you have to deal with this. So that's this. The second take-home lesson, more specific to this model, is that spinodal effects can save natural inflation from itself. I can actually do everything I want up to the value of R. So that's going to be some sort of determinant of things there. I can do everything I want without having to push any super Planckian excursions of the field. So I can stay within the domain of validity of the effective field theory. So that's a good thing. Got to be a good thing. So questions. I mean, you know, surely someone is thinking this in the audience. How do you know that the Hartree approximation captures the right physics?
Or is it getting right at
that? I believe we haven't done it this way, but I believe I could do things in terms of gauge invariant variables, and the same sort of thing would start to shake out. I mean, the modes would still sense the nonlinearities, and for the long wavelength modes. So, it's an unproven claim, but I claim that I could take care of it.
You probably know this as well as I did. So there was this theory that Robert Brandenberger was proposing, basically the same effect
right.
happening. And so there was a long, basically, there were, I guess, some discussion literature on what's the right way of doing it, and I guess what is the gauge invariant way and non-gauge invariant
right.
way of doing it. And, I mean, I don't know, we can continue that discussion, but I guess I kind of settled. Just,
well, I mean, that in the ideal world, that would be the thing to do. It's a little bit harder, but so my not proven, but my claim is that I could do it, and the results would be similar. And in fact, at some level, it probably falls into the category of looking at the stochastic picture and getting at the same result. Okay. So how do I know that? So given that I use the Hartree approximation to do all these things, how sure am I that it's a good approximation? So the problem is that calling it an approximation is kind of ennobling it far beyond its what it should be dignified with, because it's the n equals 1 large n approximation. 1 is not large. And what it really should be called, and you know, if I'd been more honest, I'd have called it this, is a Hartree truncation. You're just throwing graphs out because you're throwing graphs out. So one of the things to do is you should check to see if those graphs that you're throwing out are in fact smaller than the graphs you're keeping. Fair enough. It's hard. But on the other hand, I would say to the haters, whatever you're going to do, there is this tachyonic instability in your system. What are you going to do about it? Are you just going to say it's never there? You can say maybe it's not gauge invariant, it never shows up. I don't think that's true. You got to do something. You got to say some set of words to deal with that. So I would put part of the onus, at any rate, on the people that just do natural inflation without worrying about this. And furthermore, actually, if you do large N, the same sort of effect actually shows up there. The same sort of resummation of growth of fluctuation shows up there. The problem is why you don't see sort of a two-phase inflation in large N is that the spinodal line is right at the bottom of the potential, because that's where the Goldstone modes go massless. And so if you've chosen to zero out your potential energy at the bottom of the potential, there is inflation, but it's with zero cosmological constant. So there is a sense in which you're seeing the same phenomenon in the Hartree approximation that you're seeing in a large N well-controlled approximation setting. It's just that the physics is just different because of what you've chosen to do with a zero of potential energy. So what's left to do? Probably get a better grip on the Hartree approximation. That really wouldn't hurt, especially because it looks like it could be useful in this category of problems. What we're doing now is actually sort of trying to delineate the R versus NS parameter space in terms of the initial conditions on field, et cetera, sort of getting a better understanding as to what's possible, what's not. One can play around with models with more than one axion, different symmetries, say non-abelian symmetries, and see what happens. There's some interesting models with non-abelian symmetries that give rise to more than one axion and coming in an interesting sort of group theory combination. So we're looking at what you can do with that. So anyway, that's what I did with my winter vacation, other than skiing. Thanks.
Going back to what Nynish was saying, so I would think that from Weinberg's theorem, it tells us about adiabatic mode. If you have one degree of freedom, it's always an adiabatic mode, which means at late times it approaches a constant. So I would think that that tells you that negating your any variables, you wouldn't see this.
Now, let's see that. To be fair, I know the theorem, and I haven't thought about how the fact that these really long wavelength modes are somehow seeing this instability, I don't really know how that plays out. So that's something that's something to really check into.
If we lose bisector power and the tensor mode tilt in T, everybody gets scalar variance at 0.96. Those who do inflation, those who don't do inflation, there are dozens of models and potentials in common. So how do we ever decide what's correct?
I don't know, Kendra. I'm passing to Kendra. I don't know.
It's a fair criticism.
It's a fair question. I mean, it's a hard, then it becomes a real hard question to decide.
I don't disagree. But, again, it's not my fault, right? In the sense that nature will give us what nature gives us. If R is small, it is what it is, right? But so at this point, at this point we're reduced to hoping for the best, or maybe some interesting non-Gaussianity is still somewhere that can be ferreted out that we can try to use for something. But it gets a lot harder that way. I mean, if everything keeps popping up vanilla, everyone can reproduce vanilla, right?
Yeah, so. Consensus. Some people, well, many people agree who don't.
There's another avenue that is, go away from models and into honest to God theories.
Come on. I mean, it's not like people aren't trying to do that, right? But honest to God theory is hard. It's really hard. Yeah, if you believe in string, then you try to do. Try to be as honest as you can with stringy models and get something out of it. Difficult, right? But I think you're right. I mean, that winds up being if nature is really unkind and it hasn't really been doing a whole lot for us of late, right? Then we have to hope that theoretical aesthetics at some level is enough to point us in the right direction. Physics it has a theoretical aesthetic component to it as well.
I guess the whole thing's not. I just wanted to make a comment that I think Azal, who actually lived, so she did her PhD thesis on this very topic, a back reaction of infrared modes on. But I think at the time, we and others came to the conclusion that if you look at it from a gauge invariant way, for the local observers, this is not an effect that's observable. But I think this is something that. My predisposition is the opposite of yours, is that there are some calculations that do it in a given environment, and then fine.
But you say that the long wavelength modes do not affect the background for small
distance. No, they do, they absolutely do. But it's not observable to us, basically.
But changes in age aren't observable.
The last 60 E foldings happen the same way.
In essence, I would say, I don't think we disagree, because I'm just saying that the full background evolution is changing due to these modes that are extremely long. The modes that leave at the last 60 E folds, I agree that they're going to do the same thing. It's just that the background's going to be different that they evolve in.
So the question is, do they use that for original potential or this?
That's the question. So. Yeah.
But I don't see how even I would certainly agree that local observers can't detect wiggles in long wavelength modes. No argument there. But they must surely be able to have some effect in just the background geometry.
I think the idea is that the effect is just changing the time that everything happens. So some
but that must be sort of a perturbative statement. I would bet
that that's a perturbative statement, not a resum statement. Because I think that would be true if I only kept the lowest order perturbation result from here. That's essentially what would happen. It's in the resummation that you actually see some different behavior.
Okay. So I'm good.
All right, any more questions?
Thanks.